4:55 on Monday, October 24th. All right. So, looking at the calendar. So we're running a little bit behind where I thought we would be, but that's okay because I had a couple of days of extra time sort of built in to deal with that. We're going to today finish talking about the network layer, hierarchical routing and multicast, and then move on to talking about the link layer, which means that previously the wireless was before the exam, the wireless has been moved after the exam. So the exam will just be on essentially TCP congestion control through what we talked about at the end of next week on link layer. I'm thinking that for the final project, I'm going to open it up to be either an implementation project like it has been in the past, or more of a project of your choice. I have some ideas about things that would be useful and interesting to do as either implementation or kind of researchy projects, and that might be better for some people. So we'll talk about that at the end of next week. The exam is on Monday the 7th. I am not going to be here Monday through Wednesday of that week, so I think I'm just going to give you Wednesday as a day to work on the project. I will be back on Thursday, and so we can talk about any problems that may be cropping up in the project before it's due on Friday, which is a holiday, but if you want it done before that, get it done before that. So you turn that in online on Friday. And then wireless, after the exam, we do wireless and start security, and essentially there's 3 weeks of that spread over 4 weeks because of the Thanksgiving break, and then we'll have final exam. So that's the remainder of the semester. We're two-thirds of the way through, I think, right? No, not quite. Well, I'm optimistic. At the end of this week, we're two-thirds of the way through. So, any questions? It's good to look at the Chapter 5 problems because they're help for the exam. So, we're going to talk now about hierarchical routing and routing in the internet just briefly, hierarchical routing is important because it sort of is the real world meets routing. Routing in the internet is such a complicated proposition that there's sort of no way to do it justice in even a day or two of lectures. So rather than do that, I think it's better to just say, if you ever are in a position of having to do actual configuration of networks in the internet, you've got a lot to learn. All right? Even having learned what there is in this class. In particular, Border Gateway Protocol, BGP, is a monstrous thing you really have to understand in order to participate as a system administrator in the sort of internet at large. OSPF and RIP, the routing protocols for a local subnet sort of situation, a WSU campus or something like that, is not too bad. But BGP is a whole nother kettle of fish, as they say. So we'll just talk briefly about hierarchical routing, and then we'll move into talking about broadcast and multicast. Okay, so here's what we you know, we talked about these algorithms, the distance vector and link state, but it's such an oversimplification, right? Because it's something that assumes that all of the routers know about every other router, essentially. And that just doesn't work in the internet. So, to overcome that, we have to come up with ways to do essentially hierarchical routing, that routers know about sort of whole classes of other routers and don't have to know about the details. That's where this term internet actually arose, was that an internet is a network of networks. And the whole idea of this hierarchical routing stuff is to say, all right, so you've got an internet, you deal with the routing in that one, and I'll just deal with, you've got a network, I'll just get the traffic to you and you figure it out from there. And so there are tricks in the addressing that are used to make that simple. We saw that before when we looked at the longest prefix routing. That meant, the fact that we were using longest prefix meant that when we had a whole bunch of networks that all had a common prefix, we could just have one routing table entry to send to that whole class of networks, and so on and so forth. And then, of course, once you bring in this idea that it's made up of a network of networks, then the owners of the individual networks need to have some say in how things are done within their network. So you can't force a single policy everywhere. So the concept that has arisen to deal with this is the idea of these so-called autonomous systems. That's something that somebody owns and operates according to their own rules, and then we only have to sort of at the public level deal with the interface between the autonomous system and the rest of the network. We don't have to worry about what's going on inside. Inside an autonomous system, you do what's called intra-AS routing, and you can do whatever you want for your routing in there. You just have to obey the rules for the outside. So the key here is that the routers, both inside and outside, both inside ASs, I should say both. The routers in ASs are configured based on information obtained from both the intra-AS algorithm and the inter-AS algorithm. And inter-AS routing is mainly about the gateway routers, the things that are at the boundaries of the autonomous systems. And the trick here is that a lot of the inter-AS routing is manually configured, right? That we don't even try to do completely automatic configuration of inter-AS routing because there are situations where this guy doesn't want his this is too simple a picture, but this guy talking to somebody else may not want his traffic to go through AS2 under any circumstances, right? He may have paid for this connection to carry a high volume of traffic. This one's a lot more expensive. This one might be a connection over a cell phone link that gets really expensive. So you wouldn't want to do that. Too much detail. Configuring. Too much detail. Do too much detail. I just don't want to go into this. And we're going to skip over this part really fast. Intra AS routing, interior gateway protocols. The common ones are RIP, which is ancient, OSPF, which is newer, and IGRP, which is Cisco's. I don't know how much people run RIP anymore. It's really for very small networks would be the idea. OSPF got popularized in the late 80s and 90s, and RIP is distance vector. OSPF is RIP is distance vector, and OSPF is link state. The only thing that I think is tricky about this is the name open here. Open refers to the fact that it's a public protocol. That's publicly published protocol. Anybody can implement it. Okay, so we're not going to do RIP. For your project, it's worth looking at the RIP discussion in the book, just as an instance of a distance vector protocol. It's good to see about that. OSPF, link state, VGP, this is the one that I said is so complicated. Lots of policy possibilities in VGP, etc. Okay, I know that's sort of high speed, but your responsibility for it is minimal, so don't worry about it. But certainly, if you ever are in a position of being a network administrator, you will need to know that stuff in detail. There are whole books about BGP. Well, there are whole books about a lot of things that we've talked about. There are whole books about DNS. There's whole books about what else? DNS. Well, whole books about specific DNS server implementations. Whole books about routing. Whole books about TCP. You know. Okay. So most people, though, to use TCP, don't need a whole book. It's only when you get into implementation that it gets interesting. All right. Well. I want to talk about broadcast and multicast. So the idea here is that we want to send a message once and have it delivered by the network, have it replicated in the network to a whole bunch of destinations. The reason being that it is inefficient to have a source duplicate the message for all the destinations, because then the message has to transit all the links, transit early links in the path multiple times. So the whole idea of broadcast or multicast is that you send a message once and it only goes across any link once. Right? Whereas if you did duplication at the source, it would go across links multiple times. There's also the problem that if you're broadcasting or multicasting using source duplication, you actually have to know at the source the addresses of all the destinations. Whereas with a good multicast or broadcast algorithm, you can sort of keep the source from having to know that. So multicast and broadcast are instances of duplication happening by the network. There are several approaches to this, and I think we're going to look at each of them in turn. But you can think about different ways that this could happen. So in the early in original Ethernet, for example, we haven't talked about link layer yet, but we will. In original Ethernet, when you sent a message on the wire, it was essentially received by all the nodes on that same network. It was what is known as a broadcast medium. Your wireless connections are broadcast medium. You send something and everybody on that network can receive it. Okay, so there isn't actually any duplication required in those networks in order to do broadcast. But what about a routed network like the internet or something, where you actually are sending to destinations that are sort of scattered all over the place? Then you need to actually have duplication done by the network, and there are different ways to do it. Flooding says whenever I get a broadcast packet, I just send it to everybody that I know about. Well, you have to do something about in that scheme, because otherwise, if every time you get a broadcast packet, you send it to everybody who you know about, then those guys, when they get it, they're going to send it back to you. Right? And that leads to what's known as a broadcast storm. It's not pretty, okay? Because there are uses of multicast that have failed to take that into account, and well, they try to take it into account, but they take it into account incorrectly, and then you actually get one of these broadcast storms, and essentially can bring your network to its knees. It becomes unusable. So you have to control the flooding, and that means that you only forward it if you haven't seen it before, but that imposes on you an obligation to keep track of what you've seen before, right? And that's additional work, additional storage that you have to do. Or you can use this reverse path forwarding trick, which we're going to talk about. And finally, there's this process of building a spanning tree for the network, and we'll talk about how that works, that essentially builds a set of forwarding paths that assure that there are no cycles and that no node ever gets the same packet twice, although there are then issues about the robustness of that, because what if a link in the tree breaks? Things are not working anymore, and you actually have to repair the tree before you have a working scheme. So, spanning tree, we not have a... Oh, I see. Thick layers. So, remember what a spanning tree is. Hopefully you've heard about spanning trees. Heard about spanning trees? Okay. So, spanning tree is a acyclic graph that reaches all of the nodes of the network. So there are no cycles. And you obtain it by essentially deleting edges that are already there. So those are not there. And if you don't consider those, you see that what we have is an acyclic graph. The idea is that any node in here, this is the more interesting one, if you pick any node in here and you forward the broadcast packet only on the spanning tree edges, then it will reach all the rest of the nodes, regardless of where you start. I mean, it's sort of obvious in the case where you start at the root of the spanning tree that that's what happens, but in fact it's true regardless of where you start.
Can you keep the same spanning tree graph rather than construct a new one based on the source node?
That's right. You only need one spanning tree. Right? See, you don't. It doesn't depend on which. Doesn't depend on where you're sending from.
Yeah, I was just thinking about efficiency, but I guess it's really not that important.
Well, yes, you can. Right. So notice that this one has a much longer path to F, and you could improve on that. So we will see later when we talk about these things that some schemes actually build a, well, more in the case of multicast than broadcast, some schemes actually build a sender-specific tree. It sort of is application dependent, whether you want to do that or not. So how do you get a spanning tree? You start with a node. There are a couple of different ways to do it. You start with a node, say E here. And say node E is going to be the center of the tree, and we'll use our unicast routing, which we presumably already have. We'll use paths from that, or we'll use routing from that to construct a spanning tree. And so what you do is you say, all right, I'm node C, say, and I want to join the tree. I send a message toward to E. Right? I say multicast join or broadcast join. Still doing broadcast. Broadcast join message to E. I just send it into the network, and it gets to E, and it says, okay, well, that got to E, so C is now part of the tree. Similarly, D and F. Now, B says, the same thing. It says, what's my route to E? It says, okay, my route to E is through D, so it sends this join message to D, but at the point where it gets to D, it says, okay, this is a multicast join message. I'm already part of this spanning tree, so that's the end of it. I don't have to send it any farther. And now B knows how to be in part a part of the spanning tree, and so on and so forth for everybody else. Well, that's fine for broadcast, but what about for multicast? So multicast is like broadcast, except that the destination set doesn't include everybody. It's just a subset of the nodes that you want to send to. Same issue about conserving network resources by not sending things multiple times. So, again, we're going to want to have trees to avoid cycles and the issues associated with flooding. But now the question is, do we want a source-based tree, which says that every sender has its own tree, it sits at the root, and that tends to minimize the cost in terms of hops taken to get to every destination, or do we want to have a shared tree that all the members use, as we saw before for the broadcast one? You can do it either way. We are going to get to reverse path forwarding, I think. Okay, so the good thing about a source-based tree is that it gives you the shortest path to every destination. A shared tree can end up having the least cost. It makes it possible to minimize the overall cost of the tree, but in the situation where you're not including every node in the tree, it actually turns out to be an NP-hard problem to construct that minimal tree. That means that it's, you know, it has high computational complexity. So let's look. shortest path trees, essentially you just build the use Dijkstra's algorithm to find the shortest path to each of the included destination nodes, going through nodes that are not necessarily part of the tree. So even routers that don't have any direct subscribers to the multicast tree have to participate, right? And that's pretty necessary because you can have a router at a key location that just if it didn't participate, then you couldn't get to anybody who was downstream of it. So you have to do that. Okay. So that's just Dijkstra's algorithm. Yes, reverse path forwarding. So you can get away with a sort of flooding algorithm and not have to directly construct the multicast trees by paying attention to your unicast routing rules. Essentially, if you know, let's see, do I have a picture of this? Yeah. So, it's kind of a flooding algorithm. It says, this guy sends a multicast packet going to all of these guys, the red ones. Wait a second. Yes. Needing to go to all of the red ones, but the non-red ones, the ones with no direct subscribers, are also present in the network, of course. And the rule is, when you get a multicast packet, say here, you look and say, did it come from the place I was expecting it to come from? Did it come from the place that I would send a packet back to the source from? Wow, complicated sentence. So here, router 2, look at router 2. It says, okay, if I were sending something to router 1, where would I send it? I would send it up this link. Okay? So it says, okay, well then that's a good packet, and I will forward it out all my outgoing links. But look at router 4. Router 4 gets this packet from router 2 and says, would I have sent a packet to router 1 on that link? No. So I don't forward that one. But it does forward this one. So notice that packets do go over these unused links in the tree. They just get ignored at the other end. That's interesting. Yeah, and it may be a bad choice with asymmetric links, because I suppose that in fact going from router 2 to router 1 is better going this way, but from router 1 to router 2 is better going this way, then you've built a suboptimal solution. Sometimes you can get some of the routers with no group members out of the tree using pruning, it's called. So notice in the previous picture, previous picture, the reverse path forwarding rule has said that router 5 sends to router 7, and also to router 6. But router 7 knows he has no subscribers, and router 5 knows he has no subscribers. So router 7 can say to router 5, I have no subscribers. Router 5 then knows that he has no direct subscribers or subscribers from anywhere else, so he says, prune me off. I don't need to get those messages anymore. This then introduces the problem of what happens if somebody shows up down here and wants to subscribe. Right? So then you have to have a way to join back into the tree, but that's doable as well. So Steiner trees are not used, so let's not talk about those. That was a source-specific tree that came out of using reverse path forwarding, because it depended on the fact that the multicast packet was actually sent from a particular location, and the behavior that you got depended on where it came from. The center algorithms work like they do for the broadcast. You send join messages to the toward the center, and when they hit an existing part of the tree, they stop. So that's not. In the internet, so the interesting thing about multicast in the internet is that, to first approximation, ISPs don't implement it, so it isn't very useful. That's the most interesting thing about it. There are protocols that exist based on distance vector and on reverse path forwarding. And then they use pruning. That's the key thing, is that to the extent that there is multicast in the internet, pruning is very important, because mostly things don't want to subscribe to multicast. I mean, the question that I have at this point is, you know, with all the distribution of media going on these days over the network, YouTube and Hulu and Netflix and so on and so forth, you might think that there would be good use for multicast, but it imposes a lot of constraints on the application, right? If you're multicasting a movie to everybody who's watching a movie at the same time, they all have to be watching at the same place, and we sort of don't use our movie watch. We don't. One of the things about internet media is that we're able to do what we want to do with it instead of what the television station wanted us to do. So that kind of isn't terribly useful. Another use of it is like for meetings, right? Conference calls, Skype meetings. That's a place it could be useful, but I suspect, again, that the total amount of such traffic is so low compared to everything else, the junk mail and the junk websites and all that stuff, that it probably just doesn't make a lot of sense to most internet service providers to do much about multicast these days. So in the 90s, there was this thing called the M-bone, the multicast backbone, that was created to experiment with multicast in the internet. But I actually haven't heard of anything happening with that for a long time. Nobody's told me to go to a meeting and use MBone to access it. In the early days, people were using it to broadcast seminars, for example, in real time. These days, of course, what we do is we record the seminars digitally, and then anybody can watch them later. They don't have to come at the same time. So again, tunneling comes into play. Since the ISPs don't implement multicast, by and large, we can implement a set of multicast aware routers and tunnel multicast traffic between them. So we don't get the full benefit of multicast over some of these links, but we do get some of the benefit. That's fine. That's fine. We don't need to talk about that. So that's the network at a high level. I guess the thing that I have come to most appreciate about what has happened with the internet is that the decisions that were made early on, that is 20 plus years ago, about how to do all this stuff, have sort of turned into the internet we know it today, as we know it today. There have been tweaks along the way to it, but overall, you know, those guys made really good decisions about how this stuff should work, except in one area, and that's security. Right? They just didn't take that into account, and we have an internet today as a result that sort of anybody can get on, right? You can easily get onto it. Once you're onto it, you can send traffic anywhere, you can get traffic from anywhere. The underlying protocols just allow all this to happen, and you don't have to worry about it, except for the problem of security. So I was just reading over the weekend, somebody from the FBI is now proposing that we should start a parallel internet to the existing one that would have the characteristic that essentially you can't put anonymous traffic onto it. You have to sort of be responsible for your traffic. And that's a quite different model from what we have today with the internet. There are certainly places where that would be very useful to have, right? You'd be very useful to be able to interact with your bank in a way that said a lot of things. Certainly all the stuff we're doing with power system controls that live on internets, that would benefit from living on networks like that. But it's not clear to me that that's actually achievable.
Well, it has to be lucrative for it to even happen in the first place. Anyway.
Well, yes, it has to be sort of economically justifiable in some way. I think the security issues that we're facing with all this networking and interconnectivity are sufficient that that's probably the case, that there would be an economic justification for it, except for the fact that I'm not convinced that it's really achievable, because here's what I'm thinking. Suppose that I have a computer, all right, and I super duper new internet. I connect it to the super duper new internet, and other people do too. And the problem is that, and everything that we do is sort of securely done. Everybody knows where all the traffic comes from. Blah blah blah. Okay, and it grows to have a few billion hosts on it. All right. Well, what do you think the possibility is that old-fashioned internet, that somebody is going to do that at some point, hook up the same node to both networks? Easily done, right? It happens all the time with modems and wireless networks today, and there's no reason to think it doesn't happen then. And then this node gets compromised over the old-fashioned internet. It gets a virus or a worm or something that essentially lets anybody out in anywhere use this node to send traffic as this person onto the super duper new internet. Well, it's better than the current state of affairs, because at least you can look at that traffic out here and say, oh, it's coming from him. You at least know it's coming from him. But does he really have responsibility for it? Well, you'd have to have an awful lot of rules. And if you had all those rules that made you responsible for any traffic that came from your machine, and this ever happened and you got sued for $500 million or $1 billion because of what happened over here, well, that's pretty scary. So would you ever hook up your machine to that network? Yeah. I don't know. It's an interesting idea, but it's more when we talk about security. But
I just think that the Big Brother aspect of it is disturbing.
I agree. I mean, I think that there's no way that you could force everybody onto this into this mode, which means that this one still exists, and once this one still exists, you have this possibility of bridging them, and then what happens? Yeah, I agree. I don't think any. Well, I shouldn't say I don't think anybody. Yes, there are people who think that everybody should have to live in this world, but I think there are a lot of people who don't, who have a sort of more realistic view of how oppressive governments work and so forth, that say this would be a really bad thing in the history of the world. Yeah, Dominic?
There have been some legislative attempts, I don't remember like how long, maybe like 5 years or whatever, like maybe Lieberman or somebody was like, let's stop the defamation on the internet,
right.
Like make it so everyone has to be identifiable, right. No one was having it.
Nobody would have it, exactly. But certainly there are roles for networks like this if we're going to do certain kinds of sort of physical system controls, that you'd really like to have a network like
that. The government already has something kind of similar in their CipherNet.
Yeah. Yeah. They try to keep it separate. Yeah. So anyway, that's the network. Onward to links. Links are much less controversial. Links are much less complicated in some ways. Getting closer to the actual photons and electrons that make all this happen. So we'll start with that next time. Okay?